Hello and welcome to Ask Margot. This is the show where we explore the real questions of life, relationships, identity, emotional well-being, purpose, self-management, love, loss, direction, and the deeper patterns that sit underneath the lives we create. Because life is not only happening around us, but also happening through us, through our thinking, our emotional responses, our subconscious patterns, our decisions, our standards, and our connection to something greater than ourselves. Today, we're talking about some fascinating things: dinner party etiquette, whether emotional addiction to a person is real, what emotional maturity looks like, and why some people always seem to feel guilty. So whether you're listening from afar or near, thank you for joining me today. I'm Margot de Coatsworth, and this is Ask Margot. Our first question is from Jane. She says, how do you capture a man's attention romantically? And equally, how do you capture a woman's? Most attraction begins with one thing. You might call it presence. I call it energy. People think it's purely physical, but I think our attraction is energetic. A person who is fully engaged, warm, confident in themselves, and genuinely interested in life and other people is already far more attractive than somebody trying desperately to impress. Men and women are individuals, of course, but generally speaking, they're often drawn in by slightly different things. To capture a man's attention, I think femininity has enormous power. And femininity is not weakness, it's warmth, playfulness, calm, charm, ease, mystery, energy, aliveness. A woman who is enjoying herself is magnetic. A woman who is self-confident, who can flirt lightly, laugh easily, make eye contact fully, and create warmth around her is often far more compelling than somebody trying to appear perfect. Men also tend to respond strongly to appreciation. Not flattery, appreciation. Well, they quite like flattery too. But they want to feel admired, appreciated, and that you find them interesting. And many men love a woman who brings atmosphere with her. Someone who makes life feel more beautiful, more fun, more alive, more emotionally uplifting. Women, meanwhile, are often captured somewhat differently. Women usually notice attention to detail enormously. A man who's attentive, emotionally present, and intentional stands out immediately because, surprisingly, few people truly pay attention anymore. Confidence matters, not arrogance, confidence. Calmness, direction, steadiness, a sense that he knows who he is and can lead himself through life competently. Women often respond very strongly to a man who follows through, communicates properly, notices things, remembers things, makes an effort, and creates steadiness. And appearance does matter, not in terms of good looks necessarily, but in care. People underestimate style and self-presentation sometimes, but it's called grooming and it's important. A well-dressed man is attractive because he instantly communicates, I make an effort and I care. Women notice a man who smells good. For both men and women, though, attraction deepens through emotional experience. People remember how you made them feel. Did they feel seen, energized, relaxed, interested in, admired, understood, more alive around you? And one of the most attractive qualities anybody has is to already have a life of their own, with interests, standards, purpose, enthusiasm, and direction. There's something deeply magnetic about a person who already is engaged with life, rather than waiting for someone else to become their entire source of identity, activity, happiness. It is quite a burden to have to create a life for another person as well as yourself. So choose someone who's capable of doing that for themselves and has proven it, because nobody wants to be leaned on by someone who's supposed to be their equal. So perhaps the real secret is not learning tricks to capture someone's attention at all, Jane. Perhaps it's becoming somebody whose presence genuinely enriches the experience of another person's life. We are magnets, and we need to be projecting what we want in order to magnetize having that come back to us. We can't have what we are not a match for. Our next question is from Sally. And she said to me, what are your thoughts on dinner party etiquette for guests? It feels as though a lot of social manners have disappeared completely. That's a great question for me, Sally, as it's one of my little hobby horses. And in my cookbook, Take Five and Cook the Dinner Book, there's a section in the middle just about this very question. So these answers are distilled from my book. Social manners do sadly seem to have disappeared in many cases. And I think it's a pity, because good manners are not about snobbery. They're about making other people feel comfortable and ensuring both guests and hosts have a good time. A good guest makes life easier for the host, not harder. And hosting can be a little bit nerve-wracking for people anyway. A good guest will tune into the atmosphere of the evening and behave accordingly. They understand that hospitality is an offering and not a stage upon which to perform every preference, opinion, dietary requirement, and emotional reaction. So here are my rules for being a good dinner guest. Never begin eating before the host unless they tell you to. Never speak with food in your mouth. It is unspeakably gross. Don't do it. Not now, not ever, never. No one in the known universe considers what you have to say important enough to watch the food roll around and fall out of your mouth because you want to simultaneously eat and speak. Oh, that's a biggie for me, as you can probably tell. Never ignore the host's wishes, whether you are asked to begin eating, or asked not to help clear dishes, or not to do the dishes. Never declare your food preferences or allergies at a dinner. Tell the host beforehand, or be quiet and just play with your food if you can't eat it. Never say anything that may resemble criticism of the food, no matter how constructively you feel you may be saying it. Don't even agree if the host wails about something being dry or burnt or failed. Think creatively and find a positive comment. Any cook will already know when they have missed getting it right. You could even help by diverting and praising something they've done well. Try not to interrupt excessively. Imagine you using an Indian talking stick and let the person speaking finish what they're saying before you have your say. Never use worse language than the host. Never wing it with which cutlery you decide to use. Work from the outside in, and when in doubt, observe the host and follow suit. Never leave the table without excusing yourself, at least to your neighbour. I don't need to say, don't take your phone and don't answer calls or texts, do I? Never start an argument unless the host encourages you to do so. Never dominate the conversation. It's tedious and trying for others, no matter how amusing you feel you are. Never outdrink others at the table, especially the host. Read the atmosphere and sensibilities and arrange your behaviour accordingly. Never stretch across someone for anything. Ask, nod, wink, point or smile, but never reach, stretch or throw anything at the table. Never clear, pass or stack cutlery and plates at the table while someone is still eating. Deter others who may try to do this at a very inappropriate time and just stop them by saying that you prefer to wait till the others have finished. You may also do this in a restaurant where the staff have not been trained by their mothers or their boss. All these rules go out the window if the host announces that you must now pass or stack your plates. Hosts may pretty much do whatever they wish, even if it contravenes all laws of etiquette. Never leave your cutlery in a random fashion crisscrossed on your plate. When you've finished, arrange your knife and fork so they are parallel and it's clear that you've finished. Do not hold your utensils vertically like weapons, and do not wave them about when you're talking. Don't clean your red lipstick or makeup off with your linen napkin or use it for any other questionable purposes unless it's paper. It's just not necessary. Get up and find a tissue if you need one. It's not essential to take a gift, chocolates or flowers, but it is a good thing. It's also a very good practice to phone, write, or even email a thank you as soon after the event as you are able. Strictly speaking, flowers should be sent beforehand or afterwards, but these days we tend to take them with us. One little extra thing here. If you are a solo gentleman and you're often hosted by others and not hosting in return, then take something more with you, not just wine. Take flowers or a foodie gift. Otherwise, your often hosts may feel put upon and unappreciated. Do your bit or take them out to dinner and pay for it. Just because you're a man, it's not a thing that you don't have to reciprocate in some way. Think about it. Don't just take it for granted. Then even your company might not be compelling enough for people to invite you on an ongoing basis. In summary, tune in first to the host, then the other guests, and you'll prove yourself to be a sought-after guest for future dinner parties. And honestly, the whole point of etiquette is not to impress, but to make life considerate, more civilized, and more enjoyable for everybody at the table. Fab question, Sally. Thank you. Our next question is from Julia. And she says, can a person become emotionally addicted to somebody? Because sometimes what people describe as love seems more like obsession to me. Withdrawal, anxiety, and emotional chaos seem to follow in its wake. Ooh, yes, I think it absolutely can, Julia. And one of the reasons this is so confusing is because emotional addiction can feel very intense, which people then mistake for deep love or extraordinary chemistry. But intensity and health are not the same thing. Some relationships create steadiness, safety, and emotional nourishment. Others can lean towards obsession, anxiety, hypervigilance, emotional highs and lows, and constant uncertainty. And strangely enough, many people interpret that instability as passion, particularly if they've been conditioned to associate inconsistency with love. A huge part of emotional addiction is something called intermittent reinforcement. In simple terms, this means the reward is inconsistent. The person is warm, then cold, present, then distant, attentive, then unavailable. And because the affection is unpredictable, the brain becomes highly focused on trying to win the connection back again. It creates a self-perpetuating cycle. The occasional text, the brief affection, the sudden attention, each little moment of connection creates a surge of emotional relief and pleasure, and the person begins to chase that feeling. It's a bit like gambling. You pull the lever because maybe this time you'll get the reward. This creates enormous emotional fixation. The relationship becomes less about peace and partnership and more about hyped anticipation, craving, relief, fear of loss, and emotional dependency on that person responding. That's why some people feel almost physically distressed after certain breakups. they're not only grieving the person, they are withdrawing from the cycle, and withdrawing can feel brutal. Your brain keeps looking for the next emotional hit, the message, the reassurance, the reunion, the affection. Without it, people can feel flat, panicked, restless, empty, or desperate even. There's another layer to this too. Many people remain emotionally attached to unhealthy relationships because they fear there is nothing better available for them. That fear is incredibly powerful. If I lose this person, what if nobody else comes? What if this is my only chance? What if I never feel this strongly again? And because of that fear, people tolerate relationships that are emotionally exhausting and psychologically destabilizing. They confuse attachment with destiny. But a relationship that consistently creates anxiety, confusion, and emotional depletion is not necessarily evidence of profound love. Sometimes it's evidence of emotional addiction. A healthy relationship usually creates more steadiness over time, not less. You feel more secure, more yourself, more emotionally balanced, not constantly waiting for the next emotional earthquake. I also think many people need to ask themselves a difficult question. Am I in love with this person, or am I addicted to the emotional cycle they create in me? Because those are not the same thing. Real love generally allows expansion. Emotional addiction often creates contradiction. One creates greater emotional stability, and the other tends to produce obsession, insecurity, and in the end, depletion. That does not mean there's no genuine feeling involved, because there often is, but the chaos surrounding it can become chemically and psychologically compelling in its own right. So if someone finds themselves trapped in one of these dynamics, the goal is not simply to get the person back. The goal is to regain clarity, self-respect, emotional steadiness, and perspective, because love should enrich your life, not repeatedly destabilize it. And one of the most important things a person can learn is that emotional intensity is not always proof of emotional truth. Might be time for such a person to take a break and focus on themselves in order to gain some clarity, Julia. This next question we've got is a kind of follow-on. Angela says, what do you think emotional maturity actually is? Because some people seem calm, measured, and self-managed, while others seem to be completely at the mercy of their emotions and reactions. Well, I think emotional maturity is one of the most important and underrated qualities a person can develop, because it affects absolutely everything: your relationships, your work, parenting, friendships, communication, leadership, decision-making, and even your health. And yet many people move through life without ever really learning it. When I think of emotional maturity, I think firstly of self-regulation, the ability to feel something without immediately reacting, exploding, collapsing, attacking, spiraling, or just reacting impulsively. Emotionally mature people still feel things very deeply. They get hurt, annoyed, disappointed, angry, frightened. The difference is that they're not instantly overtaken by those emotions. There's a gap between feeling and reacting, and that gap is important because it allows a person to think, to take a beat, to assess, to calm themselves, to choose a response rather than simply discharge emotion everywhere. Everything around them determines their internal state if they're purely reactive. A difficult comment can ruin the day. A disagreement becomes a crisis. A delay becomes outrage. A disappointment becomes a catastrophe. They are constantly being emotionally thrown around by life. And after a while, that becomes exhausting, not just for them, but for everybody around them. And another huge part of emotional maturity is accountability. Emotionally mature people can usually say, well, yes, I got that wrong, or I overreacted, or I could have handled that better, without collapsing into shame or defensiveness. Emotionally immature people often struggle a lot with this, and everything becomes a denial or blame or justification or deflection, that's a big one, or victimhood, because taking responsibility feels too threatening to their sense of self. Let's think about the delayed reaction part. I think one of the signs of maturity is the ability not to react instantly to everything. So not every thought you think needs to be spoken out loud. Not every irritation needs to become a confrontation. Not every emotional wave needs to dictate behavior. Sometimes the wisest thing a person can do is pause, sleep on it, think about it, let the emotional charge settle. So say, I need a moment, or I'll come back to you about that, and then do so. Because many disasters in relationships and families come from people reacting at the height of emotion instead of at the height of clarity. Communication matters. Emotionally mature people generally become better at expressing themselves clearly without becoming excessively reactive or destructive. They can say, that upset me, or I didn't like that, or I need to think about this, without turning every difficulty into warfare or drama. And maybe one of the greatest signs of emotional maturity is the ability to remain fundamentally steady, even when life becomes really uncomfortable, because life will become uncomfortable. People will disappoint us. Things will go wrong. Loss happens. Plans fail. Criticism arrives. Pressure comes. And emotionally mature people do not avoid discomfort. They learn how to maintain themselves within it. And that's a huge difference. I think maturity also has very little to do with age. Some people become wiser, calmer, and more self-aware over time. Others simply become older versions of the same unmanaged person they've always been. Age does not necessarily equal wisdom. So emotional maturity is not automatic. It's developed, but it first has to be chosen. I think the world would function very differently if emotional maturity was valued as highly as intelligence, success, or appearance. Because a mature person brings great steadiness to a room and to their sphere. And that's one of the greatest gifts a human being can offer other people, Angela. Our last question today. Why do some people always feel guilty? I often feel bad if I've upset somebody, Jamie says, fallen short, not done something quickly enough or well enough, and I don't want to carry guilt around all the time, but I don't quite know how to stop it. I think many thoughtful people struggle with this, Jamie, and it often comes from a combination of over-responsibility, conditioning, empathy, and a deep desire not to disappoint or hurt other people. The problem is that over time, guilt can become almost a default emotional setting. The person begins to feel responsible not only for their own behavior, but for other people's emotions, other people's comfort, other people's reactions, and even their disappointment. It's quite a heavy way to live. Healthy guilt has a purpose in terms of awareness. If we have genuinely behaved badly, hurt somebody unnecessarily, acted unfairly, broken trust, or failed to take responsibility where we should have, then guilt is simply a signal that says something here needs to be addressed. And in those cases, the mature thing to do is quite simple. Front up, address it, apologize sincerely, correct it where and how you can. But after that, something important becomes necessary, and that is to let it go. Because carrying guilt endlessly does not improve anything for anyone. Doesn't undo anything, doesn't heal anything, and very often it becomes emotional self-punishment. Many people confuse guilt maybe with goodness. They think, if I feel guilty enough, it proves I care. But caring and carrying are not the same thing. You can care without carrying guilt. Some people have been conditioned early in life to feel responsible emotionally for others. Perhaps they had volatile parents. Perhaps they learned to keep the peace. Perhaps they became the fixer, the helper, and the one who absorbed the tension in their household when they were young. Those people often grow into adults who feel guilty extraordinarily easily, even when it's not their responsibility. Eventually, guilt can become almost automatic. And sometimes guilt can be used as a form of control, wicked emotional control, where people consciously or unconsciously become very skilled at making others feel guilty to gain attention, gain compliance, avoid accountability, or keep relationships functioning on their terms. So people need to ask themselves, is this guilt actually appropriate? Or have I been trained to feel responsible for things that are not truly mine to carry? It's an important distinction. Animals, when they escape from danger, will often physically shake themselves to discharge that fear or that intensity. And we're not so good at that. Perhaps we need to think about that and just learn better to shake things off. Ask yourself, have you done something to feel guilty about? Can you fix it? And then let it go. Well, that's us for today. If you have a question, please feel free to send it in to me under the contact tab at margounlimited.com, Margo with a T, or to admin@coastaccessradio.org.nz. Thank you for joining me today. It was fun. Let's hear now what the universe would like to say to us today. This relates to a question someone had about why their happy outcomes were not showing up. You are to hold the outcome and stay there. That is your job, and it is my command. You cannot change your mind or allow thoughts contrary to this outcome to enter your mind and play havoc there. You and only you must shut down the things that do not serve. These things are not outcomes, as you have been looking at. They are your thoughts. Your thoughts are your powerhouse, your energy to get from A to B. They are your authority. Require your thoughts to line up with your desires. They have not, and you and only you must change that. Thank you for your company. See you next episode.
This program was produced at and first aired on Coast Access Radio with support from Erirangi Te Motu, New Zealand On Air. You can listen back to this and many other programs on coastaccessradio.org.nz, Spotify, iHeart and Apple Podcasts.